This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
Well, again, welcome to our third of the Great Decisions lecture series, five speakers. The next two lectures will be in two-week intervals, so in 2 weeks from tonight, we'll have a speaker talking about digital dissent, the origins of revolution in Egypt, and the role of social media in the Arab Spring. And then 2 weeks after that, on April 26th, we'll have Beyond Green, Responsible Property Investing Trends and Strategies. If you've picked up one of the flyers, the title's just a little bit different. We had sort of a generic placeholder until the speaker got back to us on the title. He's still going to be talking about the same general area. There's flyers in the foyer outside if you want to pick one up on your way out. For the 55th year in a row, Great Decisions is coordinated by the Political Science Department, which includes political science, cross-cultural studies, peace studies, and international studies majors. Several years ago, as a new faculty member at Whitworth, tonight's speaker addressed Great Decisions, and we are so excited to have him back, especially given how infrequently he is in Spokane now. As director of Whitworth's Costa Rica Center, Professor Lindy Scott now resides in Costa Rica, expanding the long list of Latin American countries that he has called home. Professor Scott, who joined the Whitworth faculty in 2007, received his PhD from Northwestern University, his Master's in Divinity and Master's degrees from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, and his bachelor's degree from Ohio University. He is a regular commentator on the national radio programs Primetime America and Open Line, where he presents a Christian perspective on contemporary politics. He also serves as the North American coordinator and treasurer of the Fraternidad Teológica Latinoamericana. Which means the Latin American Theological Fellowship. Professor Scott received the Christian Writer of the Year Award from the Asociación Cristiana de Periodismo in Mexico. The award was given to him based largely on the book Salt of the Earth, A Socio-Political History of Mexico City, Evangelical Protestants, which was published in English and Spanish and has become a classic in Mexican Protestantism in the 20th century. More recently, he co-authored the book Terrorism and the War in Iraq, A Christian Word from Latin America. It is from this work that reflects his extensive experience in Latin America, in U.S. politics, and in Christian theological thinking that he will speak from tonight in the lecture that you can see behind me entitled Latin American Christians and U.S. Foreign Policy, The War in Iraq as a Case Study. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Lindy Scott back to Great Decisions.
Thank you, Patrick, and thank you for inviting me to speak to the Great Decisions series. And this is a very difficult topic. It's going to require that we all put our heads and our hearts and our minds and souls into it, because we're going to talk about war and death, and we'll be talking about the war in Iraq and as seen by Latin American Christians. It was definitely a great decision in the sense of an important decision by President Bush to decide to go to war. It was his biggest foreign policy decision, and he will be judged by history about the validity of this war. Some people think, why Latin America? Latin America is pretty far away from Iraq. It has very little influence in that part of the world, has very little to benefit or lose from what happens in the Middle East. But if you think about it, Latin America does have some reasons to be involved. As you know, Colin Powell went to the UN Security Council to get authorization to invade Iraq, and you needed a supermajority of 9 members of that 15-member committee to approve the war. And it came down to the last, they just needed one more vote, and the last two countries to express their position were the two Latin American countries, Chile and Mexico. And we will look at what they decided and why they decided what they did. Also, Latin America is far from the scene, but therefore they might be more objective and can look at it at a certain distance and maybe give more serenity, more thoughtful perception of what was happening than those whose countries are directly involved in the war. So we will look at that tonight. And this was motivated for me to study the topic as I saw that the differences of opinion by the church, the churches, the Christians in the United States, and the Christians in Latin America was so large, the difference was so great, I wondered why. Why did the churches see it so differently? And that was the motivation to study and to explore what churches in Latin America thought and said and pronounced about the war. And that has definitely affected me. It helped. It led me to co-publish a book with Rene Padilla. It led me to begin a journal in English of the Latin American Theological Association called the Journal of Latin American Theology in 2006, so that English speakers, English readers can have access, greater access to what Latin American Christians are thinking. It comes out twice a year. And it also motivated me to run for Congress in Illinois. And some of you old-timers might remember an old movie called Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And he was, Jimmy Stewart was the idealistic Mr. Smith. He was going to go to Washington and change Washington. And so I was going to go to Washington to change Washington. So Mr. Scott goes to Washington. I just didn't know that it was going to be Washington State and not Washington, D.C. So here I am. Let's get started with some of my basic convictions. These are my biblical convictions, my personal convictions, but I think they're reasonable. All followers of Jesus are members of one great family, the body of Christ. And if you remember St. Paul's thinking about the body of Christ, we need each other. To be a functioning body of Christ, the hand can't say to the head, I don't need you. We need every member of the body. And that's not only true for a local congregation, but it's true for the body of Christ worldwide. Every individual, group, culture, and nation demonstrates some very positive characteristics because we're all made in the image of God. We represent God. And in spite of the fall, we demonstrate some very good qualities. Nevertheless, some of our weaknesses and sins come from we're all fallen creatures. Every individual is fallen, every local church is fallen, every culture is fallen, and every nation is fallen. So we have this strange mixture of being good representatives of God, made in His image, and fallen creatures who distort that image and distort God's message. So what do we do with that mixture, individually, as an institution like Whitworth, or as a church in a country? Well, we desperately need the sight and help of others to overcome these weaknesses and develop our fullest potential. We're going to get into some very deep topics tonight, but I'd like to illustrate this part, the need for a second opinion and the need for someone else to speak a word into our life by something that happened to me when I was a much younger man. I was 25, living in Mexico, and I got my first teaching position at a national university. And here I am, a gringo, 25. Back in those days, I had a little bit more hair than I do now. In fact, I had a really good-looking afro. Curly hair, looking good. And so I started teaching, and in Latin America, generally, you begin teaching, and your work papers sort of get... they come along a little bit later. So I've been teaching for a couple weeks, 7 to 11 in the morning, class at 7 in the morning. And here I'm teaching. And then I have an appointment at 1 o'clock with the university lawyer, with the university president, and other members of the administration. So I'm excited. I even put on a coat and a tie. I seldom wear a tie today, these days. But I had a coat and a tie. Taught my class. I had 2 hours to waste. Between, so I sat down on the ground under a tree, in a tree with beautiful orange flowers. It was great. I fell asleep. And when I woke up, it was 5 to 1. So here I go running for my appointment. And I get there, and the lawyer looks at me, and she begins to smile. She looks at my face, at my head, and I thought, it's a good afro, but you don't need to stare at it. And she keeps smiling and looking at me. And I thought, well, I'm a white guy with an afro, but still, that's okay. And she laughs, and then we get down to business, and I sign all the papers, and then she presents me to the president. He looks and smiles at me. He keeps looking at my head. I thought, it's not that unusual. And I introduce myself to all the administrators, and they all keep looking at my head. And I don't know, and I go, seems in order. I leave, and I'm walking down the sidewalk, and I look into the window of a car, and I look, admiring myself, and I see a big orange flower in my car. And I try to retrace my steps mentally. Where did that flower go? The lawyer didn't put it there. The president didn't put it there. It had landed there when I was sleeping. Or maybe some student came by and stuck it in my hair, but I did not feel it. And so there's nothing wrong with having beautiful orange flowers in your afro. But that was not the first impression I wanted to make with the president of the university. But it illustrates the point that we all have blind spots, and some of our blind spots are funny, but some blind spots can cause an accident if you pull out and you don't see the car in that blind spot. And for a nation that is considering going to war, we have blind spots. How do we detect those? How do we try to get a second opinion? How do we find a mirror that can tell us culturally, ethically, the blind spots that we have? That's the topic for tonight. It was a great decision in the sense that the cost of war usually is much higher than people think. Just like tuition, things keep going up, but a cost of war goes up quite a bit. February 2002, George Bush's advisor Kenneth Edelman said, "The invasion of Iraq would be a cakewalk." He couldn't have been more wrong. Wars come at a high financial cost, and the Iraq war was not an exception. Through fiscal year 2011, the war had required $806 billion in federal funding, and counting all the social costs of soldiers who get maimed and the social rehabilitation and health care, it's between $3 and $5 trillion in economic costs for the U.S. Humanitarian costs is even more striking. Of the 4,800 coalition deaths, 4,486 were suffered by U.S. military. Iraqi civilians suffered even more. Between 105 and 115 Iraqi civilians died up through 2011. And 2.8 million Iraqis have found themselves internally displaced by the war. A quick timeline. As you know, 9/11 2001 was a devastating blow to the United States, and the United States sought UN approval on the world community to act in self-defense and take out Al-Qaeda. Then in 2002, President Bush goes to the UN and states, well, we have a war, we need to fight terrorism wherever it is found, and we need to consider taking action against Saddam Hussein and Iraq. The UN gave approval in Bill 1441 for UN personnel in different countries to look at Iraq, to go into Iraq and see if there were weapons of mass destruction. That was the main accusation, that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, that they had previously used them, and they would use them again against neighbors near and far. And so that was the accusation. The UN agreed to send inspectors, and Saddam Hussein seemed to play a cat-and-mouse game. He would say, look in this building, you think they're there, and the inspectors would look and would not find any, but you would see some activity as if Saddam was moving his weapons to another building. And so Saddam said he didn't have any, but he gave hints that he might. Now, if you know the situation between Iran and Iraq, it's understandable that a macho dictator doesn't want to say, I'm totally defenseless, attack me. So it's understandable that he would try to bluff and pretend he didn't have, even if he did, or that he had, even if he didn't. We knew he had chemical weapons earlier because we, the United States, had sold those weapons to him in the 70s and 80s. The question was, had he really destroyed all those weapons as a result of the first Gulf War? In October, the Congress of the United States, I believe, abdicated their responsibility. According to the U.S. Constitution, the Congress is the institution that needs to declare war. They need to examine a situation and be very precise. If they declare war, what is its purpose? What is its goal? What are its limits? And the U.S. Congress, Democrats, Republicans alike, and independents said, President Bush, here is a blank check. You can use whatever force you need in Iraq. February 5th, 2003, Colin Powell goes to the United Nations Security Council to try to persuade at least 9 members of the 50-member council that Saddam Hussein, yes, did have weapons of mass destruction, and therefore he was a menace, and he needed to be taken out. And it comes down to a vote. Before they get to the final vote, the countries show their hands, and 8 of the 15 say, yes, you have approval to invade. 5 said no, and Chile and Mexico said, not yet. Let's think about it. Mexico had a new president, a president who was friends with President Bush from the PAN party in Mexico, but it had been a 3-way election in the year 2000, and President Fox looked at the fact that he only had about 35% of the people voting for him. The other two parties split the other 65%, but the Gallup polls in Mexico showed that Mexicans were 95 to 96% of Mexicans were opposed to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Now, there were offers that if Mexico would support the invasion, that 11 million undocumented Mexicans would have a fast track to getting citizenship in the United States. Even that was not enough to move President Fox to vote in favor of the invasion. Chile then had the final vote. And when we make the case, there's a dictator in Iraq, and he has weapons, and he will use those weapons against his own people and against neighbors. Chile says, we remember September 11th. We know that date very well, because September 11th, 1973, we had a democratically elected president in Chile, Salvador Allende, and the United States CIA organized a coup to overthrow our president and install a general who became a dictator, General Pinochet, who killed 30,000 members of his opposition. So yes, North America, we recognize that you suffered on 9/11, but we also suffered on 9/11. So Chile expressed that it would not approve the invasion. The fact that these two Latin American countries had the final votes, the important votes in the UN Security Council, probably motivated churches to be more outspoken. So when they speak out about the war, they're not only speaking to Christians in the United States, they're not only speaking to the US government, the British government, the Spanish government, but they're also trying to show Chile and Mexico, who have the deciding votes, the people of Latin America are not in favor of this invasion. I'd like to give you some of the criteria of just war, and then we'll look at some of the statements by about a dozen Latin American Protestant churches. The Catholic Church in Latin America was also very much against the war. The Pope himself came out very much against the war and tried to dissuade the United States from going to war. But the criteria of just war theory usually have 7, 8, or 9 principles of which all must be met before Christians should go to war to kill. The first 4 talk about what are the conditions that need to be met before you enter war. The last 3 or 4 have to do with how do you fight Christianly. The church has been, has tried to follow Jesus' teaching in you are peacekeepers, you're called to be peacekeepers, you're called to sow love, you're called to turn the other cheek, you're called to bless your enemies. And the church has come down basically on one of two positions. The earliest position, which is the dominant position in church history for the first three centuries, was pacifism. Christians are always called to turn the other cheek. They're never allowed to fight and kill. There's a modification of that. You can fight to save your life in self-defense. But in general, pacifists would not take up arms to fight in a war. Question is, was that due to Jesus' teaching, or was it due to the fact that Christians could not serve in the Roman military because they would not recognize the divinity of Caesar? So that is an issue to be looked at. The just war theories, just war perspective, has been developed more significantly from the 4th century on, when Christendom and the Roman Empire were joined together. Church-state was joined together. Even after the Protestant Reformation, you have state churches in England, Germany, Scotland, etc. So it's a valid question. Can a government go to war, and should Christians in that country fight to kill? And so four basic criteria are needed before Christians can enter the military to kill, enter a war to kill. First, it has to be a justified cause. The reason to go to war is to protect innocent people. And so whether it's innocent Jews in Germany, whether it's innocent Iraqis in under Saddam's government, the reason must be justified. You must be defending. You can never be offensive. You can never be aggressive. You can never fight a war to see what you get out of it. And that gets into just intent. A just intent means you cannot benefit from the war. That cannot be your main motive, whether to get another country's territory or to get another country's materials like oil. That can never be the reason that you go to war. It always has to be a benevolent reason. You are willing to send your own sons and daughters into war to protect innocent civilians. Okay? Thirdly, it must be the last resort. You must exhaust all other attempts before you go to war. So diplomacy, economic boycotts, or whatever. You do everything you can before you actually go into war itself. And fourthly, it has to be a formal declaration of war. It's not anybody can declare war. It must be the highest authority that would declare war. Now, in the United States, there's a double portion to that. The United States were part of the founders of the United Nations. The United States helped write the Magna Carta, and the charter of the UN says any country can go to war if it is attacked. But if countries want to go to war in defending innocent civilians, the United Nations, the concert of nations, must come together and agree upon that. And so the United Nations, being a founder, being an original signer of that, and all the countries that are members of the UN have agreed, we will not go to war in a third country unless the UN agrees with that. And George Bush Sr. very much believed in that. And so in the first Gulf War, he got the UN approval for that. The formal declaration for the United States is that the Congress must declare war. Now, the President can declare war in an act of emergency, but then the Congress must ratify that within 1 month. So in the war in Iraq, it should have been passed by the United Nations, and the U.S. government, Congress, needs to make the decision, do we or do we not go to war? And there's a long buildup, as you can tell, from 9/11, 2001, up until 2003, March 18th. There's a year and a half buildup, and so there's plenty of time. It was not an emergency, so the Congress should not have abdicated and given a blank check. They should have evaluated the system, the situation, and made a decision, yes or no, about an invasion of Iraq. Other countries did not approve of the invasion. Canada and Chile provided an alternative. Let us have 45 more days to inspect to see if Saddam has those weapons or not. And he must agree to the inspections, full inspections, give us 45 more days. But by then, the U.S. government had battleships in the area and said, we cannot wait 45 days. And as a quote I read by Edelman, the idea was this will be solved quite quickly. 1 month, 2 months, we'll be gone. Now that brings into question, what is a Christian's relationship to his or her government? Shouldn't Christians be patriotic? Rightly understood, I believe, yes. But wrongly understood, no. The most important affirmation of the early church was, Jesus is Lord. And that sounds very good, very religious. Jesus is Lord of my life, which is part of it. But in the Roman Empire, the word Kyrios, Lord, as a title, could only be used by one person, and that was the emperor. So when any Christian said, Jesus is Lord, it is implied Caesar is not. The affirmation Jesus is Lord is not just a religious affirmation. It is a holistic affirmation. It is a political statement. I, Christian, will obey God. I'll respect Caesar, but God is over Caesar, and Caesar is not my Lord. And that's why it cost Christians in the first and second and third centuries their lives, because they were making a political statement, an absolute statement, Jesus is Lord, Caesar is not. So what is a Christian's relationship to his or her country? We should love our neighbors as ourselves. We should love everyone. We should love our country. We should love our country as a doctor loves her patient. A true doctor does not sugarcoat the diagnosis of a patient. You should say, patient, you have this illness, but these are your options. A Christian and Christians together who are called to be salt of the earth, light of the world, conscience of a society, need to speak their voice clearly and say, country, if you're doing what is right, amen, I'll vote for the person who is suggesting those alternatives. But if your country is doing something wrong and going down the wrong way, going towards a cliff, you have, I believe, a responsibility to say, don't do that. That is the wrong way. That'll bring more injustice than it will solve. And so Christians need to speak with their limited voice, with their fallen nature, with the redeemed conscience, and speak clearly after examining a position, after examining a policy, and speak as clearly as possible. And so that is where Christians need to speak up, in my opinion. People, all people should speak up, but those who follow the Lord Jesus should try to influence society and demonstrate kingdom values, values that are of Jesus' style, and not just give a blank rubber stamp to what a country wants. Okay. The Latin American Christians speak out. And for my research, I studied all the pronouncements that I could find by Christian churches, by denomination, Christian movements, Christian organizations, individual Christians, although I didn't include those in the survey. We found about 150 statements. And these were written, these were pronouncements, these were published to the degree that the churches could do so. Most of these were not individual congregations, which they might have discussed and pronounced upon, but that was more of a local audience. These were official pronouncements. We found over 150 of those. Everyone but one came out against the war in Iraq during February, during March, during April. Only one came out neutral, and that church was a Pentecostal church, and the writer said, this might be fitting into God's apocalyptic final days. Not a single church came out in favor of the war in Iraq. Now, of course, some churches were in favor, pastors were in favor, but I just want to express that what I researched and all the things I found, overwhelmingly, churches spoke out against it. As you know, Central America, Latin America has had its own samples of war, civil war. They've also had their fair share of dictators. And so they know how to live under a dictatorship. They know the evil of a dictatorship. And they know that sometimes a dictatorship is changed by a group offering to change dictatorship and promise democracy. So they've had their fair share of revolutions. But frequently the new government is just as bad as the old government. And they've seen dictators in Latin America supported by the United States for whatever reason, usually it's an anti-communist position during the Cold War. And so they know that the United States has had dictators, has supported dictators, and then has dropped them, as in Panama with Trujillo. So when they look at Iraq and Saddam Hussein, they know he is bad. They know he is very evil. They know that he has used weapons, chemical weapons, against his own people. But they also know that not every revolution is a justified revolution, that not every war to overcome injustice succeeds. And so here is what the Latin American Christians said. They've experienced war. They've experienced injustice. They know just war theory. Many of them appeal to just war criteria. Many appeal to evangelistic reasons. And so here are some of the statements. By the Latin American Theological Fellowship, the war is illegal, immoral, and inhumane, and would hide the true economic interests. Referring to England and the United States, the havoc wreaked by two Christian nations would invalidate the proclamation of the gospel in cultures whose voices and contributions we have not yet listened to nor appreciated. So there's a reasoning that will hurt evangelism in Muslim nations, but also the reasoning that the economic interests are hidden. And I believe the Apostle Paul said the love of money is the root of all evil. So many of the churches quote that as part of their explanation. The Evangelical Pentecostal Union of Venezuela said in their pastoral letter, "We express a rejection of the war that is currently being waged in Iraq and of the world war project that the great centers of world power are orchestrating. We urge the governments of the United States, England, and Spain to heed the voices that are raised everywhere in opposition to the war, because it does not guarantee the well-being or the security of any person or nation." Baptists in Latin America are the largest traditional Protestant organization. They called the invasion a great sin, and this was the Baptist World Alliance with the Latin American members present and participating. "The war is a failure of humanity to achieve the will of God for peace." Now, this is an important statement. The Baptist World Alliance brings together all the major Baptist denominations, including the American Northern Baptists as well as Southern Baptists in the United States. And as you know, the Southern Baptists were generally quite supportive of the war in Iraq. So this gets pretty difficult when the Baptist World Alliance tells the world this is sin, a great sin, and the Southern Baptists say this is a justified war. Something's going to happen. So the Southern Baptists go to the World Baptist Alliance and say, "How can you call us sinners? How can you call this a sinful war when we say it is a justified war? You guys are liberals." That was what the Southern Baptists accused the World Baptist Alliance. And so different Baptist denominations from around the world spoke up. And the Korean Baptists spoke up. And they're a large, growing Baptist denomination.
Due to technical difficulties, recording was interrupted at this point of the presentation. We will now rejoin the event in progress.
We expressed our vote through the UN, and it cost us those green cards for our Mexican compatriots. It cost us perhaps economic commerce between Chile and the United States. We voted our conscience. You decided to take the ball and run and invade anyway. The Baptist Polytechnic Institute of Nicaragua. The war against Iraq violates international law. I do not want to be an accomplice by my silence to an action that undermines world peace. They stated, "Saddam Hussein is not a danger for international security nor for peace because he does not possess chemical nor biological weapons, nor relations with terrorist organizations." I read that and I say, that's an affirmation. How do they know that Saddam does or does not have weapons? So I understand propaganda. I understand people state something that they might not have proof to back up. But how do you state that he doesn't have weapons? And in 2005, 3 years into the war, the United States had to admit, we have found no weapons of mass destruction. So the motive for going to war, excluding the UN participation, the motive for going to war was he has weapons of mass destruction and he will use them. The fact is he had destroyed them. The World Lutheran Federation, and just as Baptists in Latin America appealed to the World Baptist Alliance, the Lutherans, and there are a lot of Lutherans in Chile and Argentina and especially in Brazil, said the United States and Britain will win the war but lose the peace. And with this attack, the anti-U.S. sentiment will deepen throughout the world and will provoke greater tensions between Christian and Muslim communities. We won the war. I don't know if we won the peace. Sadly, most of these predictions have come true. The National Presbyterian Church of Mexico, and this should be of interest to Whitworth because we are associated with the Presbyterian Church. The National Presbyterian Church of Mexico is very, very, very conservative. They do not allow women to be ministers, of course, nor elders in a local church, nor even deacons. I know the church well. I've taught in its seminary in Mexico City. And so it's a very traditional church. In fact, they have strained relations with the United States Presbyterian Church over different issues. So you would think at least they would be in favor of war. They're not liberal by any definition. Yet their whole assembly made the following statements. They dedicated in their magazine, El Faro, the Lighthouse, a whole issue to the question of war, just war, unjust war, and this is what they say. With profound sadness and sorrow, we recognize that the force of international opinion was not able in the last instance to dissuade the government of the U.S. and its few allies that followed it from launching a war that will bring about suffering, misery, and death for thousands of Iraqis. The war is immoral and illegal, and utilizing a term that is traditional to us, it is a sin. We Presbyterians categorically condemn the war for the unilateral and imperialistic mentality upon which it is based. A unipolar world, Russia is no longer a superpower, in which a superpower offers us the option of being with it or against it, is an unacceptable world from a moral and political point of view. President Bush and his administration need to remember that the evangelical option is to be in favor of or against Christ. I hope you're feeling some of the anguish that I feel. The anguish of, I assume most of us are United States citizens, of being a citizen of the United States and having Latin American Christians, who I love deeply, who I respect deeply, call my country, a sinful war, the great decision of President Bush, a sinful, immoral, illegitimate invasion. How do I deal with that? How do you deal with it? How do you deal with your identity as a North American, but also your identity as a follower of Jesus? One more quote. And this was written by George Bush Sr., together with Brent Scowcroft of his cabinet. It was written in 1998, reflecting his memoirs, reflecting on the first Gulf War. The United Nations authorized the coalition to go and take out the soldiers of Saddam Hussein who had invaded Kuwait. Iraq invaded Kuwait to get control of their oil. And so the United Nations says, we must intervene. This is a just war situation. We must step in. And so after Iraq had invaded Kuwait, the coalition forces of the UN went in, kicked the soldiers of Iraq out of Kuwait, kicked them back to Baghdad. And there was the desire by some people in the administration to say, let's finish the job. Let's go into Baghdad. Let's take out Saddam. He was our friend when he was fighting Iran. We've supported him, but he's turned bad. We need to take him out. And so George Bush Sr. is reflecting on why he chose not to go into Baghdad, which is very similar to any decision to go into Baghdad. Trying to eliminate Saddam would have incurred incalculable human and political costs. we would have been forced to occupy Baghdad and, in effect, rule Iraq. There was no viable exit strategy we could see, therefore violating another of our principles. Going in and occupying Iraq, thus unilaterally exceeding the UN mandate, would have destroyed the precedent of international response to aggression. Not the U.S. being the policeman, but the world community acting as a world community to stop aggression. And we hope to establish that universal community of the United Nations to be that instrument. Had we gone the invasion route, the United States could conceivably still be an occupying power in a bitterly hostile land. And he's talking about 7 years after a possible intervention, invasion of Baghdad. It would have been a dramatically different and perhaps barren outcome. Different circumstances, but close enough to see that George Bush Sr. acted as a statesman and was trying to respond under the rule of law, under the authority of the United Nations, having gotten approval by Congress, but limited approval, limited aims, limited goals, limited action. George Bush Jr. may have read this, but decided to go totally contrary to what George Bush Sr. did. Now, most of you were not college students or older in 2003. You were about 11 years old. So I don't blame you for not having understood what the Chilean, Mexican, Colombian, Nicaraguan Christians were trying to say. But those of you who are a little bit older, who were 20 or older in 2003, were you aware of the Latin American church's response to the invasion of Baghdad? One person, two or three people. What does that mean? It means that in spite of their intentions to communicate with us, their message didn't get through. And it wasn't because they spoke in Spanish. They had these written up in English. And when the National Presbyterian Church of Mexico tries to communicate with the North American church and the flock, the people in the churches, it doesn't reach us. The Pope, with all his power in the Catholic Church, made very clear pronouncements and asked his bishops and the priests to read his pronouncement in local Catholic churches. I've been a minister. I've been a denominational president. I know that controversial topics are very difficult to discuss. I would imagine that priests in many Catholic churches in the United States had members of their flock who served in the military. It is really hard to say this war is unjust and is sinful, knowing that people are putting their lives on the line for the war. They didn't have much choice. If they were in the military, they were sent. If they opposed being sent, if they appealed, and the U.S. Congress, the U.S. military code, has a stipulation that if you are told to do an unjust action, you must obey your higher convictions and not obey your commanding officer. The My Lai incident in Vietnam, if you remember that. But it's very seldom that a soldier who signs up for the military service will then disobey an order. So it's very difficult. It costs a lot of courage to make a pronouncement on a controversial issue where you have members of your congregation who are in the military, or their sons or daughters or husbands or wives are in the military. I understand that. But I also understand that Jesus wants to be Lord of my life. I know it takes courage. What can we do? What should we do? Well, Whitworth is committed to producing global citizens. If I had my way, we would all study Spanish. We'd have to get Spanish on our belts before we get to heaven anyway, but that's another idea. We would all study a second language. We'd all live overseas in another country for a year or two. That's radical. We would all intentionally seek out information about another part of the world. We would become students of world history, geography, and languages. History is a dying profession in our country. Geography is worse. A president of the United States in 1980 was talking about the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, and he said, those blasted, use a different word, those blasted Nicaraguan Sandinistas are exporting revolution to their neighbor El Salvador. They're shipping arms across the border. And members of his party said, yes, that's right, we need to stop the Sandinistas. And members of the opposite party said, no, they're not. And we can't let this get passed. But very few people raise the question, Nicaragua doesn't have a border with El Salvador. Honduras is in between the two countries. So in basic geography, our president and most of our population failed. The ambassador to El Salvador resigned, but he had been appointed by Carter, the previous president, not by the following president. We should take ownership for our own education. Now, as a prof paid for by Whitworth, classroom teaching is super important. That's what they pay us to do. Education takes place in the classroom, but a lot takes place outside the classroom. 50 years ago, 33 years ago, you could get very little information about the rest of the world quickly. I know because my wife is Brazilian, and we wrote love letters back and forth. And it took 3 weeks for a letter to go from Mexico to Brazil, and 3 more weeks for it to come back. Did she still love me after those 6 weeks? I think so. We've been married 33 years now, so yes, she loves me. But if you wanted to know what a church thought in another part of the world, it was hard to get that information. A missionary might come to your church and tell you what's happening, but you couldn't get instantaneous information. That excuse does not fly today. If you want to, you can find information from 100 different newspapers in Latin America daily on the internet. You can have a pen pal, email pal, anywhere in the world, and you can get information. We should take charge of our own education. We can get information. We should assign. I know very little about Asia and Africa, so I'm ignorant of those two continents, and I admit that. But in a group, in a class, in a group of students, shouldn't you say, why don't you take Africa and you take Asia and you take Latin America? And you keep us abreast. If we are to be global citizens, why don't you be our ears? Bless you, Gesundheit and Salut. Why don't you be our ears to those three countries? Boy, that's an amen. That must sound like the Holy Spirit to me. Wouldn't that be great to have a generation say, we will be in charge of our own education? And if there's not courses here offered that meet your needs, if you think there's not enough on world geography, world history, from a Latin American, Asian, or African perspective, why don't you ask, demand that kind of course? At a previous institution where I taught, there was no Hispanic studies course. And it was the same size as Whitworth. And so Hispanics and non-Hispanics said, we would like to have that course offered here. And the first semester was offered. There were so many students, they had to open 2 sections. Why don't you take charge of your own education? Why don't we have a critical analysis of the major perspectives on issues? I have a minority voice here, but I love Core 350. Core 350 should debate the important issues of our day and come to better understanding, understand the subtle nuances, but then take a position. At the previous institution where I taught, I was asked to be the director of the Ethics Center. And the president told me, because he knew my style, he knows me, he said, Lindy, you've got to be fair. If you're talking about any issue, global warming, war, peace, whatever, be sure and present both or all sides of an issue. If you're having a debate, make sure you have the best speakers possible to debate from both sides. But then he said, you know, there's an even worse problem than prejudice in a debate or preferential treatment one side over the other. Our generation needs to know that there are causes we should give our lives for. And as students, you hear An economist talk about Plan A, and another economist in the same department teach just the opposite. They both sound quite reasonable. Schedule debate. Bring them together to point out their strengths and the weaknesses of the opposite position. Because sometimes we have what used to be called paralysis of analysis. We hear both sides. We don't know what to do. There are causes that are worth giving your life for. To stop sex trafficking, human trafficking, is a cause most people can agree on. To try to find a good solution to immigration is a cause we should all work on. To reduce the number of wars, I think pacifists and just war Christians can come to agreement on some issues, on some ways to reduce the number of unnecessary wars. So discuss, analyze, but then give your lives to whatever God puts as the cause of your heart. And seek out what followers of Jesus in other lands are saying. We are one body. We need each other. Not just to point out the flowers in our Afro hair, but to point out cultural weaknesses, national weaknesses that we all have that are in our blind spot. Let's have some questions and hopefully some answers.
Well, because there's only one mic, what we'll do is, how about we'll have, raise your hand, I'll come up and let you know. We'll try and find another microphone, but then maybe you can repeat the question so that we can all hear it and then answer it.
I knew it'd be a somber night. I didn't know it'd be a boring night. I didn't hear that real well.
What do Central American countries have to say about potential war against Iran or war in Iran?
The Central American Christians and the Central American, Latin American countries have not spoken out nearly as much as on the current Arab Spring and what should be done in different countries, including Iran. I think they saw their moment when Chile and Mexico had key voices in the UN Security Council. Obama seems a little bit more tentative about going into certain countries and perhaps would work more with the United Nations. So I think the Central American countries, especially that have experienced civil war, would say, we've been there, we've done that, try to use diplomacy as much as you can, try to get more regional bodies, the Pan-Arab League, to take action, but have diplomatic action much more strongly, and don't just invade, just don't bomb. So I think there would be much more caution, and that can be the right decision, that can be the wrong decision. If you believe in just wars, then you should go and fight and take out certain dictators at certain times, but it should be the last resort. We live in a much more complicated world. Governments have weapons of mass destruction. Maybe they'll use them, maybe they won't. So Latin America has been more silent, and maybe they're more disillusioned. Because with the war in Iraq, they spoke out. They lost certain privileges because they spoke out. And so I think they're disillusioned, and the United Nations was weakened under President Bush. I believe that, because he's basically said, if you don't agree with my plan, I will do it my own way anyway. And so is there a need for a United Nations? And we can point out a lot of weaknesses, but if you believe that there's a need for some kind of international body to decide over disputes, whether it's war or fishing rights or whatever, we need either to strengthen the UN and make it more fair and just, or we need to get rid of it and try something else. And so I think the Latin American countries are disappointed. And they're looking for more regional answers. When the United States said, we will not only move with NAFTA and CAFTA, but we want an all South America trade agreement, Brazil said, that doesn't sound fair to us. So Brazil presented a different alternative. And many countries preferred the Brazilian alternative. So the U.S. proposal was scrapped. And so I think actions have consequences. And the consequence to disregard the UN authority 10 years ago is still with us. And so maybe Latin Americans are saying, does it matter? Does it really matter? Those who speak out say, more diplomacy. Latin America, South America had dictator governments in 100% of the countries during either the 60s, the 70s, or the early 80s. Central American countries up until about 1994. Democracy is flourishing. Flourishing so much that one political party in any of the countries promises a whole lot and can't fulfill the promise. They're kicked out and an opposition party comes to rule and they can't fulfill their promises. So if you look at Colombia, if you look at Peru, if you look at Chile, if you look at Argentina, you have an alternating political system. So I would say democracy is flourishing in most of the countries. Now, Chavez and Nicaragua, there's becoming more and more authoritarian. But in fact, there's a lot of information out there, and there's usually opposition newspapers in every country. So I'd say, in general, you can hear differing points of view in Latin America. The educational systems are pretty good. Costa Rica is as good as the United States. Literacy is growing. And so with the flowering of democracy, things are improving politically. Economically, not so much. And so does a ruling president, is he or she able to control the media? Not nearly as much as before. And almost every country, most people, 50% of college students, 50% of 20-year-olds have access to the internet, and they can find whatever they want on the internet. Even in Cuba, my daughter spent a semester in Cuba. Her college friends all had access to the internet. And so there's greater and greater awareness and access. Do most 20-year-olds want to look for information? Or do they want to do other things with their access? Sitcoms. I love sitcoms. And after 13 hours of teaching and studying and researching, I just need a good episode of something, Friends or whatever, to make me feel better and just not think. But a half hour is different than 3 or 4 or 5 hours a night. And so we can access less valuable information, but most Latin Americans have access to a lot of information, and they know what's happening in other countries. And the ruling party in one country probably is not the same tendency of a government in power in the second country. So you can hear, oh, the Peruvians are left of center right now, and we are right of center. How's it going for them? How's it going for us? So there's a lot of comparisons of left of center, center, right of center. You don't have the extremes anymore. The Cold War is over, but you have tendencies. From 1990, after the fall of the Soviet Union, to 2000, most countries elected governments more to the economic right. Free markets, NAFTA, CAFTA, etc. That has not worked very well, so most of the populations have now moved left of center and electing presidents who have much greater intervention by the state, social network, etc. Yes. Latin American Protestants, especially the older Protestants who have suffered persecution in their own countries, would say religious persecution is it's a very important matter. And so they try to support Christians in Syria or other places. They speak out, but they don't think they have much voice in any decision. They're from Latin America. Their voice won't be heard. It wasn't heard 10 years ago. Why should it be heard now? And so until they see the UN stepping in and seeing a resolution coming to the UN, they're not going to speak very loudly. So I know them, and the older generation says what's happening, religious persecution in any of those Middle Eastern countries, is not good. And we side with them. We want them to know that we're with them. We're praying for them to the degree that we know. But we have no power. Now, there is a growing missionary movement in Latin America. They say, you gringos can't get into those Arab countries. We look Arab. We look Muslim. We look Middle Eastern. Because, you know, the Muslims ruled over Spain coexisted in Spain for 800 years. And all those Spanish words that you think are real Spanish, they're Arabic words. Ojalá, almohada, alfombra, all the al words. And so they can get into countries that I can't get into. So there is a growing missionary movement, tent-making missionary movement, by Latin American evangelicals into these countries. So there is information getting back to them, but they know they don't have power to speak out and see any influence from their power, any impact, because what is Peru going to do about Syria? Nothing. So if it were brought to the UN, the two Latin American countries who are on the UN Security Council at that time would get some information, would get some pressure from their constituents. But until then, they're disillusioned with the international political process. Yes. The question is, what are Latin American Christian views about the United States being a so-called Christian nation? They know that Latin America has been a Christian continent, largely Roman Catholic since the conquest, and they know, if they're Protestants, that for many decades there was strong opposition, strong tensions between Catholics and Protestants, which is less now, but it still exists. And so they know that calling yourself a Christian, calling your country a Christian country, doesn't mean a whole lot. And so they recognize that although their country has been nominally called a Christian country, they know that they were persecuted, or their previous generations of Protestants were persecuted. They know that even today, when there's democracy, that very seldom does a ruling party express truly Christian principles. You can influence the party in power. You can elect a Christian congressman, Christian woman senator, or whatever, but that doesn't mean a whole lot. So they understand that the United States is Christian just about as much as Colombia is Christian. What burns them, that there's things that burns many Latin Americans. When Latin Americans fought for independence against Spain, 1810, 1820s, the basic criteria was if people came from Spain, they got the better jobs. But if a true-blooded Spaniard, mother and father were from Spain, but they were born in Latin America, they got the lesser jobs. They were second on the totem pole. Not third mestizo, not fourth indigenous, not fifth Afro-slave, but they were second compared to their cousins born in Spain who came over. So the battle cry was, Americanos, we will fight against the Spaniards. So all the Latin Americans consider themselves Americans. And so when United States people say, in America we don't do it that way, they get burned. They say, we're just as much Americano as you are. So that's one item. Second, they look at American Christians, and if the Christian says, I'm so proud to be an American, they say that's not very precise. It's fine to say, I'm so proud to be American regarding democracy, freedom of worship, and be very specific, which are good principles that the United States follows and implements. But you're proud of what the United States, the Brits, did to the indigenous population of the United States? You're proud about slavery? You're proud about ABC. So they know the sins of the United States, and they wonder, How can we be so proud about that? And they can go on and on with statements that Christians in the United States make. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. It must be a limited allegiance. If Jesus is Lord, then the U.S. is second or third or fourth. So they don't like the imprecision that sometimes Christians state. I love freedom. That's great. But you need to be precise, because I don't love what some North Americans, nor either what I have sometimes done with my freedom. And then there are some issues that are coming into debate in Latin America now that we had 30 years ago. Abortion. Abortion is illegal in most Latin American countries. And so they look to the United States and say, Christian country, should we follow your example, yes or no? So sexual issues, gay marriage, abortion, contraception, whatever it is that we fought 30, 40 years ago and are still fighting to claim that we are a Christian nation sometimes gives a blessing to all that takes place in the United States. And so they would just say, we recognize you're proud of certain things in the U.S., but don't go overboard. Be precise. Because otherwise, when you do stupid things, when the U.S. invades, just imagine, you're a Protestant in Chile or Mexico, where 95% of the people disagree with the U.S. invasion. Are you going to defend it? You're a missionary in Chile. Are you going to defend the U.S. invasion? Yes. Well, the people say, if you defend that, if that's Christianity, then I don't want any part of it. So you need to choose what you state publicly. And if you state it, you better be able to defend it, because they're going to ask you why. Just war theory? A, B, C, D. And they'll argue. Argentines love to argue. Costa Ricans like to argue. They're more polite. But they all speak, and they're in your face. Why do you believe that? That's good. We should be challenged. Right? Someone back here was going to say something. Going once, yes. Yes. The question is, with the growing economic power, especially of Brazil, are the Latin Americans looking less towards the United States? And the answer is definitely. When Brazil made its counteroffer to U.S.'s CAFTA kind of program, Latin American countries like that. Now, in Latin America, the two organizations that have a really bad reputation are the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. They lend money to repay money that these countries have borrowed from banks. And sometimes the governments that asked for the loans were these dictatorial governments that the United States propped up. And so when the loan comes due and they have to pay it, they said, we didn't ask for the loan. We never saw the loan. Why should we repay the loan at high interest? 15, 18, 20% interest. And the people never saw the loans. It was stuffed in the billfold of the government, of the dictators. I think they have a point. And so what does Chavez, our good friend Chavez in Venezuela, what does Chavez have? Oil. So with his oil, he tells Argentina, he tells Colombia, he tells these other countries, you know, the World Bank is charging you 15% interest to repay the loan that you owe to them. I'll give you that money. I've got plenty of oil money. I'll give you that, and I'll just charge you 2%. What do? Okay, you borrow the money, take it from Chavez. He's offering at 2%. That's pretty good. So your loyalty is no longer to the United States and Europe that control the World Bank and the IMF. Your loyalty is to Mr. Chavez. So he has bought loyalty from many countries. That's why Bolivia leans towards him. That's why Nicaragua leans towards him. They don't need to lean to the U.S. and expect handouts, because they get oil money from Chavez. Now, is he my example of a Democratic president? No. But he has bought friendship. And so these Latin American countries no longer have huge debts with the IMF. They no longer owe money to they owe money to Venezuela. So that's why Brazil can make its stance and make its demands and say, we do not agree with the U.S.-sponsored economic plan. Latin American countries saying, that's fine. You sound more convincing than Obama. So yes, the tide is changing. And you know it's changing it more, not just Brazil. There is a brand new stadium in Costa Rica. CRC people, how many have seen that stadium? How many have been to that stadium? See a soccer game? Soccer is the first religion in Costa Rica. And so a brand new stadium was donated to Costa Rica. Guess who donated the stadium? Don't answer that. Guess who donated the stadium? China. The biggest stadium was donated by China. Costa Rica changed its relationship with Taiwan and with China. Wonder why? So, although it was a unipolar world in the 1990s, it's no longer that. And other countries are saying, we can be more helpful to you than Uncle Sam. And they're doing it. One final comment or question? I'd like to have the last word. Yes. And that's where Latin Americans have a love-hate relationship with the United States. I mean, they love many things. They really do. Music, Hollywood pictures with all the good virtues of Hollywood. They love many things, but they also are on the downside. So if there's an economic recession and Salvadoran immigrants leave Los Angeles and they go back to their country and there's no economic jobs that they can get, then they turn to gangs, perhaps. And so gang violence exists, especially between Los Angeles and El Salvador, connections. And so they see that, and they say, what do we do? Colombia says, we used to plant corn and coffee, the good drug. But then we were forced to produce coca. Terrorists on the left, terrorists on the right told us, you will no longer plant corn, you'll plant coca. Yes? Yes. So, campesinos either planted coca, which can be transformed into cocaine, or they moved and have gone to Bogota, Medellin, other cities. That's why Colombia is the most urban country in Latin America. 70% live in those four cities. So, what does a campesino do? The United States said, we will destroy your land. We will make it impossible to plant coca, which they did. And therefore, people leave the countryside because their land has now been with pesticides and with these destroying things. You can't grow anything. But they say, Latin Americans say, the problem is a problem of supply and demand. You, North Americans, and Europeans mostly, you are demanding cocaine, and if we don't produce it, Peru will, Bolivia will. And so the cocaine production in these other countries has grown immensely, and Colombians can't produce anything on their land. Now, who is at fault? The North, Europe and the United States and Canada for wanting, for demanding cocaine, or the drug lords in the South that are forcing farmers to grow coca at gunpoint? We would expect a Whitmore student studying political science to have a good answer there. Microphone?
The North.
So what are you doing, Northerner, about this?
Not
yeah! That's good. That's not resolving the problem. So that's the kind of issue, that there's a northern view and a southern view. And maybe the north is right. Maybe it's a problem of the providers. Maybe the south is right. It's the people who want the cocaine, who demand it. But you need to understand both sides to even get a chance at a solution. So, read widely. Use the internet to look up what's happening in other countries, their perceptions. Look at their Christian news articles, newspapers, journals in Spanish and Portuguese and French and whatever language. Just read widely. And try to seek first God's kingdom. And in Spanish it says, and his justicia, justice. Christians should be people of justice, however that looks. Thank you very much.